In 1984, Erin Blackwell was 14, and she wanted the kind of stuff that everybody wants when you're a kid.
I want to be really rich and live on a farm with a bunch of horses, which is my main best animal, and have 3 yachts or more, and diamonds and jewels and all that stuff.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. It's Sound Effect on KPLU, and that bit from Erin, who's also called Tiny, comes from this documentary film called Streetwise. And in that movie, we see that Tiny really is like other kids. We watch her goof off and fall in love with a boy. We watch her squabble with her mom. But in other ways, Tiny's life is really, really different.
I think it is very strange that older men like little girls because they're perverts is what they is. I mean, I like the money, but I don't like them.
Tiny was spending most of her time on the streets of Seattle, turning tricks and doing drugs. And then she met the filmmakers Mary Ellen Mark and her husband Martin Bell. And Bell says he won't ever forget meeting Tiny.
She was beautiful and engaging and impossible to forget. But then she met all of these other kids. You know, there was Rat and Lulu, Penny Munchkin, Patrice, Shadow, Dwayne, Justin. These are kids that have been disposed of, really. They were born into the wrong bed. And there they were out on the street.
Bell says he and Mary Ellen Mark chose Seattle because it was supposedly the most livable city in the country. And yet there was this whole culture of street kids downtown. So our theme today for the show is underground. And this film is like an all-access pass to this hidden underground society.
I remember at one point Mary Ellen getting a jaywalking ticket. And right behind where Mary Ellen was getting the ticket, there were kids getting into cars, you know, turning tricks. It was like strange and surreal.
Watching this movie, you're seeing stuff that most of us never get to see. You see a young girl agonizing over which pimp to join up with. You see boys roller skating through the halls of the abandoned hotel where they live. You see Tiny wearing a hospital gown in her doctor's office, worried about getting pregnant by a John, and reminding us how young she really is.
How often you usually have your periods?
Every 4 weeks.
Uh-huh. They come pretty regular?
Well, it just started in August.
Just in August?
August 17th.
Okay, so you've barely begun. Did you ever have periods before then?
Mm-hmm.
You're how old?
14.
The movie was nominated for an Oscar, and it made Tiny kind of a star. And through the filming, Martin and Mary Ellen bonded really strongly with Tiny. And so when it was all over, they just couldn't bear the idea of leaving her on the street. So they made her an offer.
We offered Tiny to come back to New York and live with us. But there was one condition, and the condition was she would have to go to school. And she said, I ain't going to school. And that was it.
Tiny chose to stay on the street. Still, Martin and Mary Ellen kept in touch with her, and they gave her help, and they continued documenting her life. They were there for the birth of her first child when she was 16, and then again for the births of almost every one of her 9 children since. A few years ago, before Mary Ellen Mark died, they started working on a follow-up documentary called Tiny, The Life of Erin Blackwell, which will be released in 2016. So during this hour, we are going to be bringing you tales from underground, whether it's history buried in ice or the secret lives of underground cultures. But first, we catch up with Tiny. She lives in Kirkland now, not on a farm with horses and yachts. Her life has not been easy, but she can still remember what it was about life on the streets of Seattle that appealed to her.
It was like family. I mean, all these brothers and sisters I never had, you know, they just all took me in and they always watched over me, and sometimes I would go off on my own and not be around nobody, and that's when something would happen to me.
Martin says after the filming of the original 1984 movie, he and Mary Ellen basically presented you with a proposition that you could come to New York and live with them.
Yeah, Mary Ellen was like, Tiny, I will take you in. We'll take you back to New York with this, but you have to go to school. I hated school. I really regret it now. Yeah, I had all these friends, and I was attracted to the lifestyle. I really think it would have been hard to just go live this other life.
So how did your relationship with Martin and Mary Ellen develop over those years? I mean, they would check back in with you quite a bit, right?
Oh, yeah. They didn't hear from me. They was calling somebody in the family looking for me. And that's how they kept in, you know, keeping a track on me to do all the stuff that we got to do. Going to New York to talk shows, signing autographs. And, you know, we went to the Academy Awards. And then when things started fading off and didn't go so well, because, again, I was battling with downtown and my friends. I wanted to be there.
Is there something that you learned from Mary Ellen, or that she gave to you, a lesson or piece of wisdom or just an example that she set for you that has been really meaningful to you, and that maybe something you've passed on to your own family?
Mary Ellen wants family to stay together, and in me and one of my daughters never really got along as she gotten older, because she started doing some of the things that I was doing. And Mary Ellen always wanted us to be together. So after Mary Ellen passed, I really thought about it. And yeah, I do need to support my daughter in whatever she does and not be so negative and learn to get along with her and be kind and tell her I love her. And
how did you learn that Mary Ellen was ill?
I could tell, because she didn't look the same. I could tell she was losing weight. It was Martin who told me, and it was the last time that they were here to finish up on the film.
Did you have any conversations with her after you came to understand what was going on?
I asked her, you know, when she's not here anymore, what's going to happen with me? It just seems like it was going to be really hard without her, which it is. And she just was like, Mark was going to be here. He'll still be here.
In the original 1984 film, we get a really intimate picture of you and your mother and that complicated relationship, which is clearly loving but also really problematic. Have you now, as a mother yourself, do you think differently about your mother and during that period now than you did then?
I actually don't talk to my mom much, because she is an alcoholic still.
Does it still feel like the same dynamic as you had when you were a kid?
No, when I was a kid, I wanted her to be my mom and be there, and she wasn't. And now it's just like I gotten used to it, and it really doesn't bother me anymore. I mean, I have my own life with my own kids, and I just choose not to have that as a part of my life. But there's some regrets with how I've raised my kids. I mean, I wasn't abusive and beating on them or anything like that, but I mean, I could have just done differently. Then I feel like I'm my mom sometimes. It's a work in progress.
And that's kind of what this new movie's about in a lot of ways, isn't it?
Yeah.
Are you a little leery about seeing your face on screen again? Or
no, you know what? I really thought that I was going to be really nervous. I feel totally like this is what I do.
You've been at it for a long time.
Yeah, versus when I first did Streetwise and had to, you know, go on talk shows and stuff, I was like really nervous.
This is kind of a strange question for you, and I'm sorry, but I just saw the movie very recently, and it had it impacted me a lot, and I felt a real connection to you as a young child, and so here I am talking to you now. And it just makes me wonder how it feels to you to have utter strangers know so much about you, have such a connection with you, have such a one-sided deep relationship with you. Is that weird? Are you okay with
it? No. You know, I have a lot of people that has came to me on Facebook and kind of said in some words, the same thing. A lot of people said, you know, after they had watched the movie Streetwise, kind of connected with me about their life, and they changed from wanting to do, you know, run on the streets or be homeless. And so it feels good to know that I've helped people, even though I wasn't physically there. So, yeah, it's great. It's good.
I hope that's given you comfort over the years, even during hard times, you know?
Yeah. It makes me feel good.
Finally, can you just tell us a little bit more about your life now?
Well, a big part of my negativity in my life was my husband. So finally, when he left, I took it kind of hard and went through a lot of anger. And I was living down in Algona, and I met somebody that found me on Facebook. They watched Streetwise, and this family's been helping us a lot, helped us get out of there, and it's helped a whole lot.
It's amazing that this film is still so much in your life.
I'm just trying to do a whole lot better. If nothing happens for me, because I had that chance and I kind of blew it, I would really want some for my kids.
The new film is called Tiny, The Life of Aaron Blackwell, and it's going to be out in the next few months. Aaron Blackwell lives in Kirkland, and she was one of the main figures in the 1984 documentary Streetwise, which was nominated for an Oscar. Thank you so much for being on our show, Aaron.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Coming up, making your way through a scary underground tunnel like a bat would. It's ahead on Sound Effect from KPLU. Don't go away. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's show is all about underground. In the late 1960s and the early 70s, there were all these underground newspapers. They'd emerged mostly from the counterculture and the anti-war movements, and most of them actually weren't all that underground. Like, there wasn't much risk involved in publishing or distributing them. But if you were in the military and you wanted to publish stories that strayed from the company line, or even if you just wanted to read those stories, you could get in serious trouble. So that led in part to something called the GI Underground Movement. And one of the newspapers they produced, called Fed Up, was published in Tacoma near Fort Lewis from 1969 until 1973. KPLU's Paula Whistle tracked down some copies of the paper and some of the people who were involved.
What do we have here on the table?
Well, I have assembled some of the archives from the coffee house.
Stan Anderson's dining room table is covered in old GI underground newspapers from around the country. He's clearly a guy who likes to keep stuff. His house is filled with anti-war posters and such. During the Vietnam War, he was just out of the Army when he helped set up the Shelter Half Coffee House in Tacoma.
You see in this picture that I have in front of me, the Shelter Half in 1968, it shows some round tables with GIs sitting around it.
Soldiers could come in, hang out, play music, and help put together the underground newspaper known as Fed Up.
It was a fun process. People would be sitting and writing by hand, and someone else that knows how to type would type it for them.
The underground paper projected a definite in-your-face attitude. Next to the masthead, there's a cartoon of a general saying, "This here's rotten commie subversive propaganda.
And I don't want to catch any of you clowns reading it."
There was also serious news about the war and the growing opposition to it within the military.
Bullets loading, you're old enough to kill, but not for voting.
The newspaper was to the anti-war movement what the M16 was to the war. That was your weapon. That was your voice. That was, without the electronic technology we have today, there was more of a real need for the newsprint. And to distribute it on base was a mission, in a sense. It was like going on a patrol in the jungle, except you weren't going to get shot, but you might end up in the stockade.
I am General Paul D. Hawkins, commander of the U.S. Military Assistance Command in Vietnam. Here today, the U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines are joined together in a common effort to help this country.
This particular issue in my hand has a headline, Jane Fonda Banned from Fort.
That's right, Jane Fonda, actress and anti-war activist. In the spring of 1970, she was on a listening tour.
So we took her out to Fort Lewis just to talk to GIs. It was an open post at the time. It was legal for anybody to go on base without having to check in.
Easy access or not, they soon found themselves surrounded by military police, detained, fingerprinted.
Was it kind of exciting? You're here with Jane, famous Jane Fonda.
Yeah, I was a little bit taken aback by it, as were the GIs. I mean, you know, you're young men in your early, late teens, early 20s, and this beautiful kind of sexy star comes along.
Anderson ended up being expelled for life from Fort Lewis. When he asked why, they said it was because he was on post with Jane Fonda. He says it illustrates what the mood was like in the country at the time.
You don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Medevac helicopters could not find a safe landing zone out of enemy...
By 1971, nearly 54,000 Americans had died in the war. The draft meant that every male between the ages of 18 and 26 had a good chance of being sent to Vietnam.
An Allied force of more than 8,000 men today tightened its hold on the Batangan Peninsula on South Vietnam's central coast.
News of the anti-war movement was front and center.
Something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear.
It was in this environment that the GI Underground newspapers flourished and that Fed Up was being secretly distributed at Fort Lewis.
My name is Bruce McLean, and I'm an attorney here in Ballard.
Bruce McLean wrote for and helped distribute the Underground newspaper. He was drafted right out of college and was at Fort Lewis fighting orders to go to Vietnam. He says he'd sneak the papers onto the post and then try to pass them along to fellow soldiers who seemed receptive.
There was a look. People that tried to cheat on whether their hair could be over the ears or their mustache could be below the corner of their lip.
Kind of showed you as a rebel.
Made you a hippie, yeah.
As for if he ever got fooled by someone pretending to be anti-war who was really feeding information up the chain of command, he says, oh yeah.
I have since seen my FBI file that makes that quite clear, that there were agent provocateurs, we called them at the time.
Civilians also did their part to get the paper into the hands of soldiers. Stan Anderson recruited teenagers. Most got caught right away, but he says there were these two kids from Seattle.
They never got caught. They even got fed up into the firing range, into the foxholes. So when the GIs report in the morning from basic training for a rifle practice, they'd find this fed up in the foxhole. What's this? And at that time, we're talking about the late 60s, early 70s, the youth was political. I mean, you could find high school kids through college that were interested in everything going on and wanted to be part of it.
And it's one, like a two, like a three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next up is Vietnam.
Magon Cornish had just graduated from Cornell in 1972 when she and a group of friends traveled to Tacoma and became part of the collective that was running the Shelter Half Coffee House and helping to put out the underground paper.
We called ourselves the People's Trucking Company because we had traveled across country in an old post office van.
Like a lot of 20-somethings at the time, Cornish was itching to be part of the movement. Although she'd grown up an army brat, she'd turned against the war, and this, she said, felt like concrete rebellion.
It was one of the few areas in the anti-war movement where you could feel like you were really having a role, other than going to marches, you know, you're really having a role in opposing the war.
Oh, I also have over here a piece of the Shelter Half.
Stan Anderson says he'd gotten involved in the anti-war movement while he was still in the military. He'd been drafted into the Army, trained on helicopters, and although he didn't end up being shipped overseas, he never forgot what officers told him in training.
They said, you're going to fly into areas where you're going to have to shoot to kill every man, woman, and child, regardless of age. If they're moving, you shoot to kill. And somebody raised their hand. Well, how do you know if they're the enemy? The answer was, if you hit them, they're the enemy. Well, a lot of us to that was just something you could not live with.
Yesterday, the Allies killed 23 of the enemy and captured...
At the coffee house, there were a lot of conversations between guys who'd been to war and those about to go.
And you'd see that kind of enlightenment taking place already in somebody that had joined and is just being overwhelmed with the stories that they're hearing.
The war ended, the draft went away, times changed. The GI coffee house closed, and the last edition of the underground newspaper Fed Up was published in 1973.
That story from KPLU's Paula Whistle.
I don't know just where I'm going.
It's Sound Effect from KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here. Our theme today is underground. So I would like you to try and picture this landscape. You're about halfway between Olympia and Aberdeen, and it's a moonlit night. And rising up against low hills are these two ghostly profiles. It's the telltale gray shapes of nuclear cooling towers, abandoned for decades. So there's a chain-link fence that somebody has pulled up, and you kind of shimmy underneath that, and you make your way to this kind of portal into the derelict tunnels beneath Washington's mothballed nuclear power plant. Now, first you got to climb up over this dirt mound in front of the entrance, and then you slide on your belly down into the darkness. It's black and wet and creepy, but you go down there with no light, no flashlight, nothing, because you're not really planning to use your eyes. You are using your ears. That's what phonographer Christopher De Laurenti did to make his 44-minute recording To the Cooling Tower Satsop. I caught up with him and I asked him how he got so interested in listening.
My late father, God rest his soul, once said, quote, "There is no middle class in the music business." And I saw this up close, and he spent so much time hustling for gigs and doing odd musical jobs in places that he called filthy saloons. So I thought, wow, I don't really want to be a part of that because it's such a hard life. But here I am. Somehow I got lured into it. And I was lured into it through a love of sound and listening and music technology.
Tell me one of the transformative experiences you had listening to sound.
One certainly transformative experience while listening was when I went to the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle on November 30th, 1999. And what I heard was tremendous. I heard what R. Murray Schafer calls a soniferous garden of sound. There were protester chants, there was drumming from the Infernal Noise Brigade, police announcements, an incredible, incredible and rich polyphony ricocheting through the canyons of our city streets that, to me, realized that they don't only do symphonies in Benaroya Hall, there's symphonies right out here in the street.
So you do a lot of recordings of, you know, people and human activity quite a bit, but you also do recordings in just interesting spaces. Can you talk about what attracted you to a space like Satsop? And actually, maybe you could first off remind us what that place is.
A Satsop actually is the shuttered nuclear power plant in Elma, Washington. There are two cooling towers there, one which is about 75% complete and the other which is an empty shell. So these cooling towers have fascinating acoustic signatures. There's a kind of very reflective, skittering echo that literally cycles and circles up the walls as you make sound inside the cooling tower. Nearby the cooling tower are a couple of tunnels, and lots of folks have been to the cooling tower and clapped their hands and made sound and performed, and I've done that with the Seattle Phonographers Union. But the tunnels, which are close by and actually connect to the reactor and deliver water to cool the reactor core, really haven't been explored too much, mainly because they've been covered up with dirt for a good many years, and only every now and again are they exposed. to me, once I started walking inside those tunnels, I heard two remarkable things. A remarkable hum that just seemed to build and build and build like a giant chord played by an orchestra. The second sound was this tremendous slapback echo. You would stumble or fall, which I did quite a bit of because it was wet and moist, and you would hear the echo return, not 1,000, 2,000, not 5 seconds, but sometimes 10, 15 seconds later, and it would come back to you as this chalky wash. That sounded nothing like the sound that you originally made, but you know that's actually the sound that you made, albeit delayed by, you know, 10, 15, 20 seconds.
So what was your concept for this recording? What was the story you were kind of hoping it would tell?
Well, when I went to explore the tunnel, actually, I had no idea that it would or could be an album of any kind. I simply wanted to go on a journey and listen. And ultimately, that's what a lot of my albums are, is that I want to use listening as a form of inquiry. What's here? Why are we hearing what we're hearing now? So one night, I drove down and decided, well, I'm going to go inside the tunnel. And I mounted tiny microphones that are about the size of a tooth, one on each side of my head, located a couple inches above my ear to try and duplicate or capture what my ears would hear. And I began walking into the gullet of the tunnel. No flashlight, just listening with my ears.
Why did you go in without a flashlight if you were, after all, just recording audio?
I'm very interested in echolocation, which is what bats do. I thought that if I walked very carefully and very quietly, and if I listened very attentively, I could echolocate my way through the tunnel and try and see the tunnel with my ears.
Some of these sounds really are very mysterious. I mean, some of them sound like the low-down track in a sci-fi movie. Some of them sound sort of vaguely industrial. Some of them sound alien. And it's just completely divorced from what, I don't know what any of those things are. What are they?
I can guess. The tunnel, which is a fairly long tube, I actually can't give you a length in feet or meters because I walked so slowly and I wasn't looking. But for me, I think what's fascinating is that the sounds are unknown. And this is where we get to imagine and we get to try and understand what things are. If you hear something poetic, mysterious, perhaps beautiful, and you're willing to go along for the ride, well, that's when I succeed as an artist, to try and lead you in unusual acoustic spaces. So certainly a lot of it is mysterious.
You went in without a flashlight. There's very little natural light in there. What did it look like to your eyes?
For the first 20 to 30 feet, there is starlight, there is moonlight, where you can see a little bit. You can see the outline of the tunnel, which is about 12 feet wide, 12 feet in diameter, I should say. And my first time in the tunnel, I noticed a pool of water ahead of me, and maybe it was about 10 feet ahead of me. And I thought, oh, well, I'm wearing pants and shirt and shoes that I don't care about, so I'll just kind of wade through and continue. And it turned out that this pool of water was actually a kind of catch, you know, like in a sink. Well, here in the tunnel, I found myself stepping into this pool, and I was moving very slowly, and I realized, oh, I'm actually sliding. And so I just kept sliding and sliding and sliding, and then I thought to myself, how deep could this thing be? It took me about, 20 to 30 seconds, I think, where I got all the way up to my chest. Now, I'm 6'4", and as I was sinking into this muddy water, I was able to hold my deck and hoist it aloft. So I'm holding my deck above the water. I'm up basically chest deep up to my chin. Gradually, slowly, I started just sloshing my way out.
So when you're recording in a place like that, an unused or derelict kind of space, or whether you're recording a demonstration or a protest, or whether you're recording some kind of experimental music, is there something you're after? Is there something you're searching for that you hope to capture someday?
When I make recordings, I'm looking for sounds that are alive. I want sounds that are worth hearing again, and I want sounds that are worth sharing with other people that folks might have missed, and that hopefully I can record them, capture them, and share them with people who want to hear interesting things.
Christopher De Laurenti is a phonographer and a sound artist based in Seattle and also in Virginia. And we're going to have links to a whole bunch of his work at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. You're listening to KPLU's Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're talking about stories from underground. More than 73,000 American service members from World War II remain missing in action, and this is the story of three of them. Their plane went down right at this time of year, on November 29th, 1942. They crashed into a glacier in Greenland, and that significantly complicated the effort to recover the bodies. Those men and their wrecked plane are believed to be under 40 feet of ice. A Seattle man is part of a small team hoping to go out to this harsh place next summer. They want to find the wreckage and eventually bring home the remains. KPLU's Jennifer Wing looked into this story, and she found out the pilot had been in the middle of a perilous rescue effort of his own when his plane went down.
In 1942, German U-boats were all over the North Atlantic. To avoid getting attacked and to get supplies to the troops in Europe, the United States flew planes to Canada, to Iceland, and then to Greenland. If they were lucky, they'd eventually reach Great Britain. The route was remote and very cold. Mountaineer Nick Bratton lives in Seattle, but he's been to Greenland.
And the weather in Greenland is very unpredictable. And over the course of flying hundreds and hundreds of planes through Greenland, a lot of them crashed.
During World War II, two of the people who were tasked with rescuing the survivors of these crashes were Coast Guard pilot John Pritchard and radio man Benjamin Bottoms. On November 29, 1942, Pritchard and Bottoms set out to find the survivors of a fallen B-17. Nine men were stranded on a glacier on the east side of Greenland in the middle of nowhere. From their Coast Guard cutter, Pritchard and Bottoms launched an amphibious plane called a Duck.
They landed this plane that was designed to, land on water. They landed it on the glacier. This had never been done before. Then they hiked a couple miles through a crevasse field, found the B-17, pulled a couple guys off of it who were the most injured, walked back to their amphibious biplane, took off from the glacier, and returned to the ship, and these men were saved.
After that, Pritchard and Bottoms took off again on the second trip.
They landed safely. They retrieved Corporal Lauren Howarth, who was the communications officer from the B-17.
As they returned to the ship, a big whiteout closed in, and Pritchard became completely disoriented.
He couldn't distinguish ice from sky and crashed into the glacier with his radioman Benjamin Bottoms aboard and Corporal Lauren Howarth from the B-17. And those men were lost, never to be seen again.
Nick Bratton and three others hope to find these missing men when they head to Greenland next June. There have been three attempts over the last several years to find the Duck and its crew. Bratton's extensive climbing experience is what got him invited to be a part of a search in 2012, which was led by the company he worked for at the time called North-South Polar.
In the 2012 mission, our team actually gained photographic evidence of a piece of wreckage from the plane.
What is driving you to do this?
Good question. I often ask that myself when I'm hunkered down in a tent in 70-mile-per-hour winds getting scoured in Greenland. What am I doing here? And the initial motivation for being involved, I must describe as the allure of the adventure. And over time, having become increasingly involved with this project, I really became personally invested in it. So I could be spending this time doing other things, but I choose to do this because of our relationship with the families. And we want to bring these men home and find them and return them for the closure and peace that will come to their family members.
Coast Guard pilot John Pritchard was 28 years old when he died. At the time, he left behind his parents, two brothers, and a little sister named Nancy. Even though he was 9 years older than Nancy, the two were very close.
I remember one time he said, "Now, Nancy," he said, what was I, 16 or 17 years old at the time, and he said, "Now, I think you should know about liquor, so I want you, if you ever drink anything, ask for rum and Coca-Cola."
Why did he say a rum and Coke? Was it because it was safer?
Well, it was, I would think, a very mild drink. Rum and Coke rather than a martini or whatever. So I just think it was the way a brother would talk to his sister, who was 9 years younger than he. My goodness, he was concerned about my knowing what was right and what was wrong.
Today, Nancy Pritchard is 92 years old. She lives in Annapolis, Maryland. She clearly remembers that day, 73 years ago, when she was in college and got a call from her mother telling her the news that her brother was missing.
I was stunned. I remember walking around the block a couple of times wondering, okay, well, maybe he's just missing. And then you take day to day and live in hopes that you'll hear something.
When she learned what her brother did before he died, that it was his idea to go for it, to land the plane on the glacier, to do something that had never been done before, to save people's lives, Nancy says that's the John she knew.
He just lived up to the motto, "You have to go out, but you don't have to come back." Now, that is a true motto. The Coast Guard doesn't like to use it anymore, but believe me, a lot of personnel were just dedicated to that motto.
As Nick Bratton and his three partners are planning for their expedition next year, their strategy is to be fast and light. They're bringing radar equipment to see what's under the ice and a manual drill to bore a hole so a camera can be dropped down to take pictures if they find anything. The weather in June is a little more predictable, but there's never really a safe time on the ice in Greenland.
So we could be hiking as a rope team across the glacier, pulling the radar, conducting our search, and we might hear running water, but not see anything. And we might walk right over a river channel that's basically melted into the ice, but it's below the surface. So there's essentially like a tube of water below the surface of the ice that you can hear, but you can't see. You know, there are polar bears roaming up and down the east coast of Greenland as well. So that's another hazard that we have to contend with.
Nancy Pritchard says if her brother's remains are found, he will be laid to rest at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut.
I trust that those that are in charge and leading will do their best to keep everyone safe and to find this little duck that is in the Greenland ice cap. It is, that's the one prayer and wish I have before I leave this earth.
According to the U.S. Department of Defense, since World War II, 88,000 service members have gone missing or are unaccounted for. About one-third of them are considered to be recoverable. The Department of Defense has begun efforts to bring home the remains of at least 200 of these fallen soldiers every year.
That story from KPLU's Jennifer Wing. Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwen Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad. We had contributions this week from KPLU's Paula Whistle and Jennifer Wing, and producer Shane Melling. Our interns are Warren Langford and Casey Hicks. We get web help from Dave Nogueras. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. I'd like to personally thank everybody who sent words of support to Sound Effect and to KPLU over the last week or so. And we welcome your feedback of all kinds. You can email soundeffect@kplu.org. You can tweet at KPLU or at Gabriel Spitzer. And also, check us out on iTunes. You can subscribe to our podcast there, as well as rate and review the show. Come on back next week. We will be spinning some of our favorite stories about music and music makers.
Yeah, it's the Nahoku Hanohano Awards.
Okay.
Thanks. I want to hear your pronunciation.
Nahoku Hanohano?
Yes, okay. Perfect.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.